All right, we're here for one argument. I will be presiding. I'm Justice Birdwell. To my right is Justice Basil. To my left is Justice Wallach. And we will hear the case in the matter of AK. If you will announce for us, please.
The court will now call in the matter of AK. May it please the court, Mr. Richard Gladstone to argue for the appellant, Mr. Stephen Conder to argue for the appellate.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm going to attempt within my time to address issue number one, the Eighth Amendment issue, and the Second Amendment of due process with time allowed. The transfer of a child to adult court is probably the harshest remedy a juvenile court can assess. That was the thought of a judge out of a California court. Our own Court of Criminal Appeals said that transfer hearings should be the exception rather than the rule because of the harshness of it. I know it's somewhat anecdotal, but I've been practicing out in juvenile court for about 35 years. Very few transfer hearings have been filed. Even fewer have been granted. And the reason for that is 1987, the legislature passed the determined sentencing law, and that was a bridge between regular juvenile proceedings and transfer hearings. It allowed the juvenile in those cases to have a full trial, they could have a full adjudication hearing, full dispositional hearing, the due process of a juvenile, of a jury on both sides, and the state, in serious cases like a capital case, would still have the hammer of a 40-year sentence out there. And the majority of cases are handled in that fashion. In my 35 years, I've handled a few transfers. The bushel basket of cases are handled as determined sentencing cases out there because all the due process is there. Juvenile gets due process. The state gets all the remedies they can. In some cases, maximum sentence is 10 years. Some is 20. In a capital case, it's 40. And how it works is if the child is sentenced to a sentence, they're initially sent to, call it TJJD now, to be incarcerated for a period of that time. And then when they reach about 18, the rest of their sentence is done at TJJD. So initially they go to juvie, and then they go to the state prison system to complete their sentence. That's how most of the cases are done. If this case had been handled as a determined sentence case, and of course the state has an absolute right to go down that road. It's not an abuse of discretion. I'm not arguing that. They can choose whichever option they want to go to. But if this case had been handled as a determined sentence case, my client wouldn't have an Eighth Amendment argument here, wouldn't have a due process argument in my second point of appeal because the mitigation evidence would have come in on the adjudication here, on the dispositional hearing before the judge or the jury. And they wouldn't have an Apprendi argument, my third point, because they would have been entitled to a jury from both sides. But that's just in passing.
Well, let me ask you a question about issue number two. Doesn't Lewis hold that an individualized sentencing hearing is not required under 1231?
Well, I can't reach that, Judge, because that is over in the adult court, and we haven't got to that point yet.
Okay. But if you're not required to have a individualized sentencing hearing under 1231, how can you argue that you're required to have an individualized, what's tantamount to an individualized sentencing hearing under 5402?
Because my argument is the due process is being denied because there's no opportunity for that juvenile to present the mitigation order requirement for the judge to hear it. We just have a pass-through. He goes over and under Moon, and it's kind of getting ahead of my argument, that the judge doesn't even have to consider mitigation. He can consider the seriousness of the offense, the child's history, and Moon says the court doesn't have to dig around and talk about mitigation. We can just take two out of four, and we're good to go. So the court never is required to consider mitigation. And I can't think of any case in the criminal realm where the court is not required to consider mitigation. You look at all the Supreme Court cases that go back and forth, like, let's say, Penry, where mitigation is the major issue. And here there's just nothing that's requiring anyone to look at mitigation before a child is sentenced to a 40-year mandatory sentence. So, and I realize the law is established on the criminal side, but I'm asking, basically saying that it may not be established on the civil side, and of course these decisions are coming out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, and our route is, you know, to the Supreme Court at this point. But that's, hopefully I've answered that. Okay. I'm going to address the two parts of my first point, and the first point, the two issues are, first, was this child intellectually disabled, and that's the term they're using rather than mentally retarded these days, and whether the Eighth Amendment applies. As part of this case, the court appointed Monica Jeters to do a psychological. It wasn't the state's witness, it wasn't the defense witness, it was the court's witness. It's required under the statute to do the pre-diagnosed doses. The evaluation she did appeared a little bit more of a competency exam, because that's what they're used to dealing with, and there was no request in this court, in this case, by trial counsel to do a competency exam. But the exam came down from Dr. Jeters, basically giving my client an IQ of 68, and more importantly, as to the intellectual functioning, she found that my client was operating at a 1.2 grade level, which basically he was operating at a second grade level.
So what about the fact that the observation that was made that the effort for the exam, especially on anything that required any degree of effort, simply wasn't there? I mean, can you just not try hard enough so that you get a bad score?
I think there are parts of the exam. I'm not an expert on this, but I believe there are exams that they can give to eliminate that plus or minus from malingering.
But on the record in front of us, that's not addressed, is it?
No, I don't believe it is. But, I mean, I understand that subjectively she felt like he may have been malingering, but you have to understand we have a 14-year-old kid that the exam says it has ADHD and a low IQ, so what is malingering? I don't know. But I know it is a factor here, but we're bound by her findings here. And that what concerns me, that she's saying that we have a 14-year-old, you know, strapping young man, 14-year-old, with a mind of a 7 or 8-year-old, and we are transferring, in a sense, a 7 or 8-year-old to prison for 40 years. Now, of course, the 800-pound gorilla in the case is Dr. Jeters made a subjective conclusion the child wasn't retarded, and she used that term, and again, we're dealing with intellectually disabled, but it contradicts her findings, and it contradicts what's required in DSM-5 and the Moore case. The Moore case on the Supreme Court basically says we've got three requirements. If I can catch up here. Is there a deficit of general mental abilities? And again, she finds that his IQ is 68. That's her finding. Can't dispute that from either side. And, of course, there's a plus or minus on that because of psychological exams. It could be 63, could be 73 if my math is good. But anyway, she finds that there's a deficit there, and, of course, the level is 70, and below 70 is considered intellectually disabled. So that prong is met by her findings.
But how is that affected by not trying on the test?
That I don't know, Jess. I think the psychologist has the obligation to ferret that out. If they're going to make a finding that the child has an IQ of 68 and operating as a 7 or 8-year-old, they've got to either apply another test or somehow factor that in before they make a conclusion that this is their finding.
Is there any law on that?
No, because there are a lot of Supreme Court cases under Atkins as to whether that adult who's trying to avoid execution on a capital case is whether they're malingering or not as part of the test. There's a lot of law out there, and it's I think it's a fact issue for the court.
How do we make a decision between the results of the tests that she reports and her conclusion from those results, because much of the testing is subjective as well, and then she makes a subjective conclusion which is not necessarily based solely upon the criteria that she's found, but also on her observations during the testing.
I agree that that's an issue.
Which
but
would
I think
include
the
an impression that he might be malingering.
But I think her opinion is more subjective and does not meet the requirements of Moore and DSM-5. I think her conclusions are more objective because, one, she's done the testing, may not be totally accurate, but she's declaring in her report that he has an IQ of 68. It could go down all the way down to 63, and these other issues. And the other testing she did, which of course she's not saying that that's part of malingering, but the other second test under Moore is, does he have an impairment to everyday adaptive functioning? She didn't address that, but in a report she goes back and says there's a number of psychological reports that were done as part of his school analysis, and he wasn't special ed, placed in special ed, and those prior tests said that he had those adaptive functioning everyday adaptive functioning disabilities or lacks. So basically that prong objectively she found, again based on looking at the other studies. Now those studies weren't before the court, but she said, okay, I've looked at these other studies, other psychological exams, he has those everyday functioning. So the second prong of Moore is required. The third.
Tell us what you want us to hold, because I'm a little confused by issue number one. Do you want us to hold that we should remand this back because Judge Kim didn't give adequate consideration to the intellectual disability issue? You want us to hold that the evidence is factually insufficient for the transfer and there's abuse of discretion because of that evidence? Or do you want us to hold that there's some deficiency in 54.02F?
I think that I'm asking that under 5402, that because my client is intellectually disabled, that he, because of Eighth Amendment and cruel and unusual punishment, that an intellectually disabled child, a child here that's functioning at a 7 or 8 year old level, shouldn't be transferred under the statute. I'm not saying the statute is unconstitutional, because sometimes it does have to operate. I had a case recently where a young man was charged at for a sexual offense at 16. He wasn't charged until he arrested until he was 23. We came to court and he had to be transferred because there was nothing else to do. He was 23 years old. So the statute itself is not unconstitutional on its face. But when you're dealing with a child who's intellectually 7 or 8, I think that's a violation of the Eighth Amendment. Okay. And the third requirement under Moore is whether that intellectual disability has an onset prior to maturity. And of course, though, that's usually discussed in adult cases, and because my client is 14, we can assume that intellectual disability had an onset before the age. So even though Dr. Jeter subjectively said, I don't think this child's retarded, 1, 2, 3, all her testing establishes that she's met the requirements of Moore, the Supreme Court and Moore, what a disabled person is. And, the defense didn't challenge the psychological. The state didn't, object to the psychological. And since the exam, the procedure in juvenile court is weird, that psychological exam comes in as the state's first exhibit. It's just how it's done. But anyway, it was the court's presentation. So, yes, I'm saying that because sending a child, a 14-year-old child with a 7-year-old mind to prison, that's a violation of cruel and unusual punishment. I think it's excessive. And I think it's excessive because the Supreme Court, has made, for lack of a better term, accommodations for mental retardation. In Adkins, you can't execute a mentally retarded inmate for a capital offense. That's a greater accommodation under the law than I'm asking for here. And of course, the Supreme Court has made other adjustments for juveniles. You can't execute a juvenile that's under 18, and you can't give a juvenile a sentence of life without a parole. So the accommodation I'm asking for here is less than the Supreme Court has ruled in other cases of intellectually disabled children and juveniles. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Stephen Condor on behalf of the state of Texas in this case. This case is an appeal from a transfer decision by the juvenile court judge to send this case to adult court. In my research, I have found nothing that says that there's some sort of constitutional right to be tried in juvenile court. The decision upon the jurisdiction is a purely statutory matter, and whether or not Judge Kim followed the statutory procedures in making his decision. The Court of Criminal Appeals, they have laid out the standard for review on that it's whether there's four factors and whether or not his factors are supported by the evidence and whether or not his ultimate decision was an abuse of discretion. I think it's all clear today, this is all about whether the child's sophistication and maturity is such. And I think what's key is to look at, if you look at what Judge Kim actually said in his finding, when he discussed let me backtrack. First, let's look at what Judge Kim said he reviewed and considered. He considered the complete diagnostic study. He considered the child's social evaluation, the full investigation of the circumstances of the child and the circumstance of the offense before he came to his conclusion. And then he found that the psychologist, Dr. Jeter, that the defendant was capable of understanding the legal implications surrounding everything to assist his attorney, and that he had the proper sophistication and maturity. And what he looked at was, in doing this, was he looked at the circumstances of the offense as well. That the crime that the defendant planned, I'm used to criminal cases and he is the respondent, that the appellee was the organizer of it, that he was the ringleader of it, that he took actions to dispose of the evidence afterwards, he took actions to place the blame elsewhere. Now, if appellant wants to focus on the fact of this idea of intellectual disability, and now keep in mind that in terms of this is intellectual disability is a legal concept in these cases. And Dr. Jeter examined him, and yes, she did find in her test an IQ of 68 and a significantly below grade level WRAT scores, but she also caveated that, and I think it's important to send her caveat, as the court has brought up, that those scores, the things that a testee can do can cause a reduction in those scores due to a lack of effort or an attempt not to answer, as she explained. And I think there's been kind of a slight mischaracterization of the whole Moore thing. The issue of Moore and intellectual disability has been to get away from a completely numbers-driven. Prior to the Moore cases going back and forth to the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals, we had the Briseno standards where we really focused on the defining number of 70, and that was intellectual disability or not intellectual disability. And the courts have gone away from that. And they said, no, we have to look at a really key criteria is adaptive functioning.
Did Dr. Jeter actually ever testify that based in support of her finding that he was not mentally retarded, did she ever actually testify that she thought the numbers that she had obtained from him underestimated what his maturity and sophistication level were?
I don't believe she actually testified. I believe that was in her report.
Okay, so how are we to deal with a situation where the diagnostic studies, okay, show he's in the lower 1% and very difficult based upon those study results to say he's sophisticated at all or mature at all with regard to anything? How are we to look at that evidence and then to credit her testimony, which ends up being an ipsa dixit, that, well, he's not mentally retarded, if she doesn't explain how she gets from he's not sophisticated and mature to, well, he's not mentally retarded, and the judge ends up finding, well, he is sophisticated and mature. And I understand if the judge is talking about the circumstances of the crime, okay? But there was all kinds of maturity with regard to the Roper situation as well, and the Supreme Court still said
we're not going to go there. So how are we to credit, I mean, and based upon Miller or Miller itself or any application after that, has any court said when the underlying data, because just on a basic, whether it's juvenile, whether it's civil, whether it's criminal, you still have to tie under the rules of evidence your opinion to the underlying data. Okay? So in applying Miller, has there ever been an instance like this where the underlying data appear to contradict the opinion and there's no explanation for it?
I have not been able to find one of this. I think this is a unique situation, and I will give that to the court. But I also think that that's part of was the trial court's job to look at that and compare the two. And I think that's part of why we have to look beyond just the testing numbers. And you have to also look at how the person acted and how they act in their adaptive functioning, how their conduct, and whether that was in comparison to others of the same age group, et cetera, culturally matched peers. And I think that was one of the, that's why we have to look at all the different, why the courts look at all the different more factors. I also think what's important to notate if you look at the, by analogy, the death penalty cases, none of those cases are saying that the defendant in question could not face the charges of it and face be punished for the offense. They're just saying that the imposition of the death penalty itself cannot be imposed, which, and so that's kind of, I think.
The irony of Roper was that essentially Justice, the defendant was mature enough to anticipate that Justice Kennedy would change his mind between Penry 10 years earlier and his opinion in Roper. So, sorry, an aside.
I mean, and I will say, you know, in all honesty, the whole mitigation in capital cases, they're all over the map. And so, but, and so I've been hesitant to kind of really go into all that, but I think a lot of those, they, if you really look at them, they focus primarily on, can we impose a death sentence rather than actually can we try someone for a particular offense and can they receive punishment for that offense? And I have not found where they've said that because someone has some intellectual disability that they cannot be tried for the offense. The case law seems to just indicate that in a capital murder case, the state cannot seek a death sentence against someone who's been found to be intellectually disabled.
Let me ask this question. If we were to find that the evidence was either legally insufficient or too factually insufficient, what do you think the remedy is?
I believe if the court were to find that there was insufficient to support one of the findings, then it would be to remand it back to the juvenile court for the juvenile court to either conduct a more expansive hearing or to change its or to reconsider its decision. So I think yes, if this court were to find that the evidence of the record were not sufficient to support the juvenile court's finding that the defendant had sufficient sophistication and maturity to be transferred to a juvenile court, then it would be sent back to the juvenile court to either consider the question with more evidence or to decide to then just retain its jurisdiction. As for the appellant's other 2 points, I think the mandatory life sentence point, I think the stat, should this court find that it was properly certified as an adult and that he can go to adult court, the fact that there is a mandatory life sentence, I think the courts have already pretty much resolved that. The only issues that the Supreme Court has addressed is that you can't seek a death sentence for someone under 18. You can't have life without parole. I think the case law is clear that a mandatory life sentence is not an Eighth Amendment violation. There was some discussion of the fact there was no individualized sentencing, and the reason why there's no individualized sentencing is in these cases, the defendant is already getting the minimum sentence. I mean, the go away from individualized sentencing was when you're going from a minimum sentence in a capital case of life to death, and that's why you had to have the individualized sentencing. But if they're already getting the minimum sentence, which would be for capital murder life, then that's why reason there's no requirement for an individualized sentencing. As for the third point, the state would rely on its brief that Apprendi is not applicable in this situation because we're dealing with what court should properly have jurisdiction to consider this case versus whether or not we're looking at enhanced sentencing such as the Supreme Court considered in the Apprendi case. Unless the court has any further questions, the state would ask that the juvenile court's decision be upheld.
All right. Thank you.
In brief rebuttal, again, I was not the trial attorney in this case. I understood, and maybe it's out of turn to say what I heard, but basically the case was set for two days. They expected a two-day trial on the certification, which is pretty lengthy. Reading the transcript, my understanding is it went for less than half a day. The witnesses were, I believe, possibly only the probation officer in the introduction of the pre-diagnostic study. Dr. Jeter was not called. The defense attorney did not call any expert witnesses. The defendant wasn't called, and no witnesses on behalf, I use that term, the respondent wasn't called, and there were no witnesses on behalf of the respondent who were called. So it's a pretty summary procedure here. I understand that the state prepares the court's order, the judgment, as to what the court has found. I'm assuming that's how it operates. I don't think the judge drafts it per se, it possibly, but if you look at the judge's order, it goes on and on and on about the nature of the offense. And there's no question that, you know, it was a heinous offense. Every capital murder is a heinous offense. I think we can all agree on that. But the order basically centers almost entirely on the nature of the offense and how a 14-year-old could cook this up and carry it out. But again, we're dealing with a child who's operating on a second-grade or seven-year-old mental status. In the state's brief, they cite one case on this, the case of DM, that basically that was factoring in intellectual disability on a transfer hearing. I think that case can be distinguished because in that case, there were two evaluations of the child, one by the state, one by the defense. It was done for competency purposes, and again, how these things are usually done for competency. In that case, there was the juvenile had a jury trial on competency, and the jury found the child competent to stand trial. And again, that was, as Justice Baskin said, that case was on an abuse of discretion issue. It wasn't on a constitutional Eighth Amendment issue, so it was a little bit different. But again, the two psychologicals came in, competency exams, and then the jury said no, and then he went on to be transferred. But I think that's pretty much what I have here, unless Justice
has a question. Let me ask you one quick question.
Yes.
About your third issue, wouldn't we have to write isn't there a case called Lopez out of the Dallas court that says Apprendi doesn't apply in this situation?
I would have to agree that there are cases out there, but I've raised the issue. It's before the court, and I guess my argument is if this had been handled as a determinate sentence case, determinate sentence provisions allow for that due process. It allows for a jury trial in those proceedings. It allows for the juvenile to have a jury trial on the adjudication issue, and that determinate sentencing law allows a juvenile to have a jury on sentencing, which is the only time that the child is entitled to a jury on sentencing in juvenile court, and make that special exception. So my argument is that the due process and the rights are out there if they had been invoked, but here, it was summary, it didn't happen, and the child is denied a jury on basically the ultimate sentence, which is a mandatory 40 years for a child functioning at a seven-year-old state of mind. No other questions. I appreciate it, Judge.
Thank you. Thank you. Gentlemen, the case is submitted, and we thank you for your argument, and we will stand adjourned. Thank you.
All right.